Okay, we're going.
Fabulous.
Hi.
Hello.
We are here with lovely Peter Carey, talking about her new book, A Place for the Heart, and it's on my kitchen table. It's huge. I hurt my wrist picking it up.
I'll pick it up for you.
Oh, it's a beautiful book. We're here on a beautiful, sunny Tuesday. Completely forgotten all the days of the week. I had a skim through it last week and then another look at it this morning. I had to put it away because it made me cry. A beautiful book about the life and work of Dave Comer. Mm-hmm. Tell me, just kind of explain who you are. Who is Peter? What? Where do you come from?
Where do I come from? Yep. Well, I'm a Kiwi.
Bit of your mihi.
Yeah, I'm a Kiwi, and I had a fairly conventional childhood, and then I came to Fiordland when I was 17, and I met Dave. And we had 3 years together, sort of on and off around Queenstown and Fiordland and the Holyford Valley, and then I buggered off. Broke his heart.
Yeah.
And I had somewhat of an adventurous life. So, and it's sort of, people know me now and they go, you didn't. That wasn't you. And I look back and I go, no, it wasn't me now, but it was me then.
Yeah.
So I had all sorts of adventures in far-flung corners of the world. I ended up making television documentaries for most of my life. And that took me into some interesting corners, war zones and some scary places, but also some fairly dramatic situations as well. And then I suppose I just needed to come home, got tired. And eventually, you know, you have other relationships as well. And it took me a wee while to appreciate that Dave was always my soulmate, my best friend.
And you got drawn back together.
Yeah, we
did.
We never lost touch.
Yeah.
He was always the soulmate.
Yeah.
And so we came back together. You don't need to know that story. It's a bit sort of mundane. But, yeah, we came back together and, yeah, it was just easy. It just seemed right. And I think we were better people when we came back together. We appreciated each other for the right reasons.
The more Kiwis I talk to, obviously I'm not from here, the more Kiwis I talk to, the more I recognise the difference between you lot and us lot, as in Brits. As in, you generally seem to come home, whereas we go back a little bit, but we don't go back.
That's interesting, isn't it?
And because I know I'll never go home, wherever that is. I still kind of, I don't know if Queenstown will be my home forever, but I do love it. But the difference is, I think you lot always talk about coming back eventually.
There's a lovely Russian saying, I can't remember the words in Russian, but it is, a frog loves his own pond.
That's awesome.
And I think this is a good pond.
It's a bloody good pond, totally. Yeah. So how are you feeling? This has it been a whirlwind?
Well, the whole project started off, it didn't even start off as a book. It just started off as, oh, I've got to do something with all this. Because when Dave died, I was faced with the enormity of his archive. Now, he was a hoarder.
Yeah, which I've kind of gathered.
He kept absolutely everything. But not only did he keep everything, he didn't keep it in any particular order. So in some ways, I wanted to kick him up the bum.
I mean,
it wasn't kind what he left me to deal with. Yeah. But it was just necessary to have to go through everything.
Yeah.
And you might know, as a writer, because I've written all my life, even if I've made films, I've always written concurrently. I put my hands on the keyboard just to start to express myself and cope with the enormity of what had come to pass. So it was a bit of the two, you know. I sort of started putting down words and then I started going through some of the boxes and I suddenly had this idea. Also, after he died, there was quite an overwhelming kind of avalanche of media attention simply because he was the man who found Middle Earth. So there was part of me that looked at this archive and looked at all this media attention from around the world when he died, and I thought, you know what, I could use the sort of mercenary aspect of Middle Earth, but actually tell a far greater story.
Yep.
And the bigger story was his connection with Fiordland and a much more important story about the wilderness, which you'll ascertain when you read the book. And I think through his understanding and love of particularly of Fiordland wilderness, you glean an understanding of why it's important.
Because I am assuming, and from the stuff that I've heard, that the feedback about it has been amazing and actually has pulled in a whole new audience of people who were like, oh my God, there's all this stuff that we knew, kind of had heard about him or had seen this stuff but didn't know it circled around him.
Well, I mean, it was lovely the responses I had from people down here.
Yeah.
But in some ways that was inevitable. Dave was loved and respected by a great many people. So I had old helicopter pilots ring me in tears.
Yeah.
you know, people he worked with down the Holyford 40 years ago, you know, express an enormous amount of emotion. Dear
who
sweet.
Who usually grunt.
Yeah.
And not get much from. And then you're like, oh. Yeah.
So that's been really lovely. But the real surprise was when I went to Wellington and there was a whole other audience of, you know, city files who had just relished the book, just loved it.
Yeah.
So obviously it was a window into a world that they enjoyed.
And I've never met him, but when you look at those photographs of him, I can imagine a quiet, kind of, you know, deep thinking, kind, as we've talked about before, man behind those glasses. And, you know, that kind of, you can see so much in photographs of who he was, but he doesn't have to kind of say anything about that.
I think it was kind of interesting how much respect Dave garnered wherever he went. He was not a man to say what he thought people wanted to hear.
Yeah.
He would always think very carefully before he opened his mouth.
Yeah.
And you can't help but respect
that. I could learn a lot from that man.
Yeah. But he also had a very kind of quirky, dry sense of humour.
Yeah.
So that was really enjoyable as well.
Yeah. Mm. So what did you want to capture? Did you just want to get everything and put it in one place? Or did you actually want to explain something?
I think the only thing I wanted to explain was that connection with the wilderness.
Yeah.
And I really do think you have to read the book to get to a point in the understanding of the book. I don't know if you got to the epilogue.
That's the bit I went to first.
Right, okay. Well, you've got to read the other stuff.
Yeah, I know, I'm terrible.
But there's also lots of little connections through the book. I mean, some might call them esoteric, but I suppose the most powerful moments for me always happened when I was deep within that wilderness.
Yeah.
And you could call them premonitions. Sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
But I think it's got something to teach us.
The thing that I really struggled with when I came here, and I was a huge walker, hiker, tramper when I lived in the UK, and I came here and I stopped hiking, completely stopped, because I'd found, well, I'd started to run, so I used to just, why walk somewhere slowly when you can run there? I've since learned that there's a difference between the two. But the fact that in England you can point to a place and just go, whereas here, I found that really difficult. You can't often do that. I kind of completely stopped doing it because we used to go away for the weekend and we'd just point somewhere and we'd just get a map out and we'd just go there. And you can walk wherever you want. And if you get in trouble, you get in trouble. That's you do it. Mm. Whereas here, I found that I would go somewhere and there'd be a trail in front of me and there'd be signposts and there'd be blah, blah, blah. But then I started to go further and further and further into the wilderness, I suppose. And discovered that actually there's a whole other world of New Zealand that I haven't seen yet. And places like Martin's Bay, I've never been to. I have a friend who actually works around there. And she's constantly saying to me, Jane, you've got to go to these places and just stop and go. And when I got pregnant, I started to walk again. Mm. And I found a whole new love for actually that slowness of being out in the middle of nowhere on my own. And it's just incredible.
Yeah.
And it's captured so well, especially in the photographs. You just look at a place and you're like, oh my God, there's literally nobody around there.
On a very much more basic level as well, you know, Dave had all these beautiful, beautiful photographs.
Yeah.
And you can't leave them in boxes.
No.
So on a very basic level, I just thought, how do I show these to the world, you know? And so that was, that was a prime motivator.
Because who is this book for?
It was for Billy,
yeah,
definitely for Billy, my daughter. But I think it's for everybody who was touched by him.
Yeah.
But then it's for a whole lot of other people as well.
Yeah.
It's about those people in Wellington. I mean, I had one gorgeous interaction when I popped into Halliworks where we had the book launch a few days later, and there was a woman behind me. She should stop me if I'm going on about this.
Oh, no.
But there was a woman behind me and she said, are you the author? And she'd been sitting there reading this book waiting for a flight that had been delayed because of a helivac. It turns out she was a South American photographer. When I Googled her later, she was the South American photographer. She was in tears over some of these images and she said, oh, I wish I could have met him.
Yeah.
And she said, these are absolutely beautiful. So for me, to get Dave's photographs loved and respected by fellow photographers around the world means a great deal.
Because I've written down, the book shows how important choppers were and how important that whole, like helicopters feature massively in that. And so what did they mean for him?
Well, he was there right at the sort of the start of the helicopter venison industry.
Yeah.
And so you've also got to remember there was a kind of a gradual development of that industry as the machines kind of progressed.
Yep.
So you started off with some pretty basic Vietnam War technology that moved into the Hughes 500s, 300s and 500s, and then into the Squirrels, et cetera, et cetera. So Dave witnessed all that.
Yep.
And what it did was it opened up a whole way of exploring Fiordland for him, particularly as a photographer.
Yeah. Yep.
But he also formed extremely powerful friendships with a lot of those pilots and shooters.
Yep.
So I guess in many ways he saw that was a formative era in one very beautiful part of New Zealand.
Yep,
completely. And it gave him a vehicle to see it.
How did he, were you involved or did you have lots of conversations about the places he chose for, say, the Lord of the Rings stuff?
I had some.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Sir Peter Jackson was very helpful in opening up his archive to me. Dan Henner, who was art director for Lord of the Rings, actually, if I've got that title wrong, I apologise, art director or whatever he was. He was great in talking about various locations and enormously complimentary of Dave. I mean, everybody just raved about him.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I suppose how did I pick out the locations? I just knew that there were some that told a story about him more than others.
Because I wrote down, I wondered how he chose places for that particular project, but also how, at some point, he must have thought to himself when he was wandering around, I'm not going to tell him about this place. Or, actually, this place is perfect, but I'm going to keep it a secret. I wonder if...
I don't think Dave would have done that.
Do you not know?
No.
That they wanted to keep... None of it was kept special and
No,
alone.
I don't think he would have done that.
No?
No.
Because, you know, you always question, you know, there's a lot of talk now about, you know, what good has the film industry or certain films done for this country, you know, because it's brought more people and more people walk to those places. And
it's double-edged sword.
There's rubbish and there's rubber. But you actually want people to experience nature and be, you know, fall in love with trees and get to know about the land and the animals and how that works. So it is a double-edged sword.
He was very, very aware of that. And he knew that he was also someone who was responsible for, in fact, in some ways, kind of, I suppose, taking away from the wilderness as much as you bring people to it. I mean, but maybe that would have happened anyway. I don't know.
The tourism industry
is a hard one. But, I mean, even as Sir Peter Jackson says, and Tim Coddington, another producer, you know, Dave was absolutely adamant. As soon as you stepped into a location, you looked after it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was furious if there was any, you know, despoiling of the landscape.
And you also look at places like Central Otago, which when I first moved here, I worked in Cromwell and around those areas. And I completely fell in love very quickly with that kind of, not ugly, but that weird quirkiness of those places. Mm. Driving from Queenstown, which is, you know, stunningly beautiful and amazing, and then driving into those dry, dusty places that people often miss off on their lists.
And blink.
Going, I totally love these places. Yeah. And driving, it's hot and it's dusty and it's beautiful. Because what did those places hold for
him? Well, I think for him, it was a personality of the landscape. Yeah. It's what the landscape brought to the actual film or the commercial. I mean, yes, I think Paul Byrne is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's quite out there
in
a very beautiful, wild and bleak way.
Yeah.
But obviously Dave saw another kind of manifestation of something that would lend itself to a film.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love asking people where their favourite parts are around that area because everyone's one got their different one. But it's generally always the same in that, one, whenever you see a photograph of Central, you know instantly it's Central Otago.
Yeah, that's right.
And two, it's just so, it holds something for people that's just very
personal.
I think
there's one chapter in the book, in fact, I think it's one of the last chapters when I talk about The Hobbit, when I dragged my poor daughter into the Garvey Range and I thought it would be a 3 or 4 hour walk and it was 6 or 7 hours. And every time I suggest a tramp now, she just looks at me and she says, it's not going to be like the Garveys, is it? But that was pretty out there, actually.
Yeah.
That was quite, it was almost spiritual.
Yeah.
You know, I talk about the rocks like standing wide of Easter Island, but it was, maybe because it was also so lonely. You know, there was nobody there.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's just massive rocks.
Yeah.
And, yeah, massive landscape.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Do you have a favourite photograph in the whole book?
Yeah, I do.
Which one?
It's the jet boat wake.
Okay. I'll have a look.
Well, it's one of the first. We almost battled it for the cover.
Oh. We are now looking at the photograph.
And it's very hard to actually discern what it is when you first see it. And then
it looks like an animal.
Yeah.
kind of a bit of a, maybe a
like
whale.
A tail of something, doesn't it? But of course, that's the back of a jet boat that you see in the bottom left-hand corner. And in the very beginning of the story, I talk about, you know, putting a jet boat in the water from Pike and just nosing up to Lake Alabaster to warm the engine up. And then we'd turn around once the engine was warmed, because the first rapid was almost a grade 5.
Yeah.
So you didn't want to have a cutout on that rapid. And so he would always do this to warm up the engine. And this particular morning, the mist was hanging low over Lake Alabaster.
Oh.
And he just turned around and snapped that.
So beautiful.
So that would have to be it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think we talked before about the whole kindness, quietness thing, and how I think the older you get, the more that becomes top of the list around people. Mm. Especially, I mean, the older I get, the less group of friends, the smaller the group of friends I have, and the more those group of friends, the stuff that keeps them near me is the whole kindness thing. And then having a baby, that kind of the amount of kindness in this town has just absolutely blown me away. And you talk a lot about kindness.
And I think everyone uses that word associated with Dave.
Yeah.
I mean, at the funeral, his funeral, I said, you know, the irony here is that, you know, Dave gave to everyone, but he would never, ever ask for any help.
Yeah.
You know, but he was a giver. Yeah.
Amazing. Mm. Well done. Mm. Clever lady. And as I always end with my quick fire questions that you have to answer. Don't think about them. Almond or walnut?
Almond.
And I love how you say almond. No one knows what I'm saying. Mountain or sea?
I can't answer that.
Don't think about it.
Oh, well, I have to say mountain because of this book. But it's my tug of war in my life.
Sweet or savoury?
Savoury.
Books or music?
Books.
Favourite colour?
Green.
Sunrise or sunset?
Sunrise.
Morning cuppa or afternoon delight?
Morning cuppa.
Puppies or kittens?
Puppies.
One album that you could take away with you that you'd have to listen to for the rest of your life?
Oh, the one line in the book that we couldn't use was from an old Joni Mitchell song, Caught in Spark.
Which album? Not the blue album.
No, it's
Blue
Caught in Spark.
Ah, Spark. There you go. Don't know that one.
Yeah.
Well done. Peter, thank you very much.
Pleasure. Ah. Nice talking.